Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's November 6, 2019. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Guess what? I just came back from New Hampshire. It was nice. New Hampshire's pretty. I got to see a whole bunch of my buddies. I got to see my my naturopathic colleagues. I always enjoy going up there for that conference. So I went to the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors Conference. This year it was at the Doubletree. It was never at the Doubletree before in Nashua, but I guess that's where they were able to book and they got the good rate. And it's still not cheap, but it was okay, you know. And so you go and you stay in a hotel and you learn a bunch of stuff, and it's nice. And next year they're talking about doing it at the Seacoast. I don't know exactly where they'll put it in the Seacoast. They're talking about Portsmouth, but they said that Portsmouth is hard to book and even more expensive. So I don't know. And then because what they've been doing the last 4 years is they've been alternating between North Conway and Nashua. And it was in Nashua for many years. And then a couple of years, I think when it started, it was in Manchester, which was fine. But I didn't mind going to Nashua. The thing with Nashua is it's very easy to get to. It's only less than 2 hours away for me. And if when it's in North Conway, it's a long way away. But my friend Rob has a place in North Woodstock, which is very nice. So I get to hang out there. I did get to go see Rob. And so big shout out to Rob and his sweetie Victoria. And I had a very nice weekend with them. And got to see some White Mountains and got to go shopping. Got a cool new colorful jacket. It's nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fun. Right.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd give you some highlights.
And you got smart, right?
Oh, yes, indeed. So yeah. Big shout out to all of the docs that spend a lot of time and effort putting stuff together. So I want to give some highlights of some of the things that they talked about. And I'll tell you which doctor was speaking, so we give them the credit, and just some of the cool things that I learned from them. So first of all, I heard from Decker Weiss, NMD. So I guess he's an NMD. He must have gone to Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine because that's the degree they give at Southwest. So he specializes in cardiology. So here's what I'm basically going to do. Some of the things are going to be hooked together, and some of them I'll expound upon. And I'm also wondering if I'm even going to get through all of this because, my goodness, the conference was what we call very rich, very juicy. There's a lot of good information. And so I'm going to give you clinical pearls, and some things will be hooked together, some things won't, but hopefully it will be of interest. So first of all, he talked about the fear of LDL, low-density lipoprotein. So LDL is the protein in your blood that carries cholesterol from your liver to the rest of your body for use. And a lot of docs, MDs and cardiologists, think that LDL is absolutely an enemy and that the less you have, the better. And that you can lower your serum LDL down to 5 or 10, which is, which I agree with Dr. Weiss, it's insane. Because you know, you need LDL, you need cholesterol in your blood for all kinds of things. You need cholesterol to rebuild your cells because it's part of all the cell membranes in your body. It's the precursor to all of your reproductive and steroid hormones. It's the precursor to cortisol, which is what gives you your ability to just do stuff. You know, cortisol gives you energy and puts sugar into your blood so you can do things. And it's also a precursor to vitamin D. So it's very important. And when you take statin drugs, you block all of those all of those uses of the cholesterol, plus you also block your production of coenzyme Q10, which is critical for running your mitochondria, which is what at the energy center of all of the cells in your body. So what he said was that, you know, obviously getting your cholesterol, your LDL to those really low benchmarks, it's not good for your health. This is obvious. He talked about, so here's a few neat pearls. Alpha-tocopherol does decrease cardiovascular risk. So alpha-tocopherol is vitamin E, And and it's not that you should never use statin drugs. You get the best results in men who are 40 to 70 years of age and are already overweight and also at high risk for a cardiovascular event, and also 40 to 75-year-old men with diabetes. So what does that mean? Women in general, what he's suggesting is women in general don't benefit from statins. And I know a lot of MDs and docs are going to be up in arms about this. But, I mean, I might consider a statin for a woman who is at high risk. But if you're not at high risk, it may not be good for us. We need our hormones. We need our cell membranes. We need our bodies to produce estrogen in our fat cells so that we have the estrogen that we no longer have because we're not cycling anymore when we're menopausal, when we're postmenopausal. But this is what the studies show. The studies actually show it doesn't really help women. It can be helpful in men who are 40 to 75 years of age and are at risk, and also men who have diabetes. Because when you have diabetes, you're at greater risk for cardiovascular disease because of the difficulty in regulation of blood sugar and the fact that you either, if you're type 2 diabetic, you have high insulin, and the high insulin increases inflammation, and the inflammation that's caused will inflame your blood vessels. And when you have damaged blood vessels from inflammation, you're more likely to get atherosclerotic plaque. So people with diabetes of both type 1 and type 2 are at higher risk of atherosclerosis, of having hardening of the arteries. And so people with type 1 diabetes who have to take insulin, same thing, depending on what their insulin control is like. When you take insulin, depending how much you take, that those blasts of insulin can cause inflammation, still puts you at increased cardiovascular risk. Also, if you're, depending on how well your sugar is controlled, if you have too much sugar in your blood, the sugar winds up causing inflammation. And part of that is how the interaction of the insulin and the sugar, causes oxidative stress. Also, here's a 2019 Harvard study that shows that aspirin doesn't prevent heart attacks. So all those people who are taking an aspirin every day just for prevention, there's probably better things that you can do, like take vitamin E.
Weren't they taking it to thin their blood?
Yes.
Wasn't that the whole point?
Yes.
Right. So instead of taking a blood thinner, you're taking aspirin, which is...
It's a blood thinner.
Which is a blood thinner.
So let me explain. Okay, so aspirin, good question. Aspirin is a... what you're doing is you're reducing platelet aggregation. What's a platelet? A platelet is a blood cell, it's a white blood cell, that's job is to cause clotting. And so when you make an atherosclerotic plaque, so first, and the other really cool thing that Dr. Weiss did is he explained the difference between atherosclerosis and arteriosclerosis. I didn't know the difference. And he did a great explanation. Okay, so here's what he said. When you get atherosclerosis, you're building up plaque. Plaque is made of calcium, cholesterol, and platelets. So what happens is you're getting damage to the inside of your blood vessels, what's called the endothelium, the layer inside of your blood vessel. So that when you get that plaque, it's not happening. It's not like there's this blob that's inside the blood vessel. The plaque is forming underneath the surface of the blood vessel. So if you think about a tube, right? You think about blood going through the tube. It's as though there's a bump underneath the surface of that tube. So the blood isn't actually touching that bump of atherosclerosis directly. So what you've got going on is you've got damage to the inside layer of that blood vessel, and you've got a buildup of this plaque. And the plaque has, as I said, calcium, cholesterol, and platelets, and the platelets are running there to help to patch up the damage that's there. And so atherosclerosis, the athero, I didn't realize that the athero actually means pudding like. So the an atherosclerotic plaque is mushy, and so the bigger it gets, the more likely it is to finally pop. Remember how you had that hernia? Well, the atherosclerotic plaque can pop through the from underneath. It's like, it's like a molehill, and the moles suddenly explode out of the hole, right? Or a little volcano coming out. There's a hole that opens up, and the plaque comes out, and it causes more damage and inflammation, and you can block the artery. So so when it's all pudding-like and mushy, that's more dangerous than if it's calcified. Because if it's calcified, it's stable. It's not going to open up. So when that atherosclerosis is soft like that, if it builds up enough and the lining of the blood vessel becomes damaged enough, it can explode like a little volcano through the artery and then block the artery. So interesting, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have arteriosclerosis, you've got a calcified layer there. You've got calcium that's gone there to keep that atheroma, the fatty, mushy, pudding-like substance, in place. So if you have the calcium layer there, it's going to be stable and it's less likely to break open and make that little volcano, and you're less likely to have that little explosion and have a plaque gone awry that's going to block your artery and therefore give you a heart attack or a stroke. I didn't realize that. So he says, so one of the things that's done now is calcium scoring. It's a special kind of x-ray that you can get done, or a special kind of imaging that you can get done, where you can see the calcifications in the arteries, in your coronary arteries. And he thinks that if you have a higher calcium score, if you have atherosclerosis to start with, that's actually a good thing because those plaques are stable. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So so anyway, aspirin doesn't prevent the heart attacks. It does thin your blood. So here's the thinking. So you have these things called platelets, and platelets' jobs are to stick together, and they're to block up holes. So if you get a cut, you're going to get platelets in your body. They're going to run over to your cut and they're going to block it up. And then you get your clotting cascade and you get fibrin and fibrinogen, which turns into fibrin. You get a little clot and then you get a scab. And then ultimately the scab falls, and the scab gives that's a temporary patch. It's like when they fill in the road with the temporary patch until they go and they repave the road. And so they do so that's what the scab is. And then eventually your body does the groundwork. Charlie comes along and he starts doing
it's Charlie. It's always Charlie.
Charlie, yeah, comes along and patches up the hole and with the crew, and they patch up the hole. And then you don't have hopefully you don't have a scar, but you might have a little bit of a scar, but you don't have the scab anymore. Scab falls off because it's not necessary anymore. So platelets' job is to block up breaks in arteries and blood vessels and stuff like that, okay? So the thinking is, if we make the platelets less sticky, less able to stick together, you're going to have less plaques. That's the thinking. So aspirin definitely is an antiplatelet aggregate. So platelet aggregation means getting platelets to stick together. So I'm going to use that term, antiplatelet aggregation. So platelet aggregation is blocked by aspirin, but aspirin itself doesn't prevent heart attacks. So when you're talking about thinning the blood, that is what you mean. You're reducing platelet aggregation. You're reducing the body's ability to get those platelets to stick together. If you thin the blood enough, does that mean you're going to have trouble with getting more bruises and broken blood vessels and stuff? Absolutely. You see somebody who's taking too much aspirin, or they're on Coumadin, or even if they take too much fish oil, I've seen that too, because fish oil is an antiplatelet aggregator. If people take too much of that stuff, they're going to get bruises everywhere. And too much of any of those together, it's going to be harder for you to clot. So, and you're going to get bruises. And if you get a cut, it's going to be harder to stop bleeding. And that can happen with aspirin. So the other thing you should know about aspirin, though, this Harvard study showed that aspirin actually doesn't prevent MIs in the thinking or heart attacks. And the thinking is that, because of the platelet aggregation, that it should be helpful. And it's found that statistically it actually isn't. The problem is, it happens every time you take an aspirin?
No.
It hits your stomach and you bleed.
Oh, yeah. It's really bad for your gut.
And
right?
All NSAIDs do that. You take enough ibuprofen, you take enough naproxen, naproxen. They all do that. So that's an issue for all of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And you take enough aspirin, you're going to bleed every day. And so if you want your blood to be a bit thinner, It's been shown that vitamin E does help. And the thinking now is when you take vitamin E, you don't actually take it with mixed tocopherols anymore. You take it with tocotrienols, which is unfortunate because tocotrienols are more expensive than just D-alpha tocopherol with the mixed tocopherols. But that's what's shown. And if you eat, if you take a bunch of antioxidants together, so if you take E, C, and carotenoids, you know, all together, you're going to get better results than if you take any one in high quantities. And also, don't forget your purple produce. Purple produce is one of the best antioxidants. I was talking to Amy about this yesterday, my office manager, and we were talking about how high level purple produce is. And so big shout out to Brian O'Hara over at the Tobacco Road Farms. He explained that when you really nourish the produce, they express genes. They have a high level of gene expression, and one of the higher levels of gene expression is when they express the genes that bring out purple pigment. When there's not enough nutrition, you will see that plants don't have as much chlorophyll. They don't have as much bright color. They're kind of dull. You know how you were talking about hothouse tomatoes, and they're like kind of sallow looking. They're kind of like pinkish, and
they're anemic.
Yeah. Well, basically, because the way that they're grown quickly, and they're not grown in a well nourished way, and you're not getting as much color into them.
And they're chewy, and they're like,
ugh. Yeah. Well, then there's that. And then the colors that you see, when you have brilliant, vibrant colors in your produce, that means there's a lot of nutrition in them. Those colors are generally carotenoids and other colored compounds. And carotenoids and anthocyanins, which are they're incredible antioxidants and phytochemicals that are very, very good for you. And they are evidence of the plant enacting very healthy gene expression, which means that you also are going to enact very healthy gene expression. Really interesting. So if you see purple kale, it's better for you than green kale because that plant is so well nourished that it's expressing its purple genes. So when you have deep purple produce, the deep purple produce has wonderful anthocyanins in it. They are incredibly antioxidant and they're really good for your cardiovascular health. And they obey the doctrine of signatures, which means that purple stuff is going to help particularly your veins, but it's going to help your blood vessels in general. But purple produce, the anthocyanins in purple produce increase HDL, high density lipoprotein, and high density lipoprotein's job is to run around and pick up cholesterol and take it out of your bloodstream. So you're going to have less plaques if you have more HDL. So it's a better goal to raise your HDL than it is particularly to focus on thinning your blood. By the way, anthocyanins will help you thin your blood and the things that are therein. When you take phytochemicals, when you eat any plant foods in general, do antiplatelet aggregation. All the anthocyanins and a lot of phytonutrients and the fiber in general, magnesium, they all have antiplatelet aggregating activity. They don't all work on, they're not all vitamin K dependent like Coumadin is, but they all to some extent thin your blood and make you less likely to have clots. So if you just eat a really healthy diet with lots of produce in it, you're going to have thinner blood than if you don't.
Right, but you have to be really careful about getting cut or anything because you bleed like crazy, right?
Well, you won't bleed. If you're simply eating a really healthy diet, that's probably not true.
Okay.
If you take a lot of fish oil plus a lot of magnesium plus a lot of vitamin E, you might have an issue. And I've had patients come to me and say, you know, I was taking that high dose of fish oil and I noticed that I was bleeding extra. So I cut back on my dose or so I stopped. And I'm like, okay, so don't stop. Let's work on your dose because the fish oil is still really good for you. But it definitely does. It can't, when you take natural stuff that's not aspirin, like you take your fish oil, your magnesium, your vitamin E together, maybe some proanthocyanins and vitamin C, you might find that you take longer to stop bleeding. And if you're there, then, you know, you would talk to your friendly local naturopath and we'd help you, you know, adjust your doses of things so you're not so likely to bleed. And it might be better to eat more fish and take less fish oil. That would be one way to do that. So very interesting. Okay, so here's some other cool nuggets that Dr. Weiss provided us with. One of them is remember that women present with atypical heart attack symptoms. We can present like with pain in places that are not exactly precordial. So precordial pain is where you have that pain right over the left side of your chest. We will not necessarily have the pain there. It could be somewhere else. We could get pain that seems to be centered in our stomach. That's in the middle of our abdomen. We can present with headache, nausea, and fatigue. We also, when we go to the ER, we're less likely to get treated for the MI. Because,
really?
Well, because docs are not expecting it. They're expecting men to have it. And there may be some sexism there that docs are, you know, they think that the women are just complaining, you know. And the truth is, we are more likely to complain. And I don't mean that in a bad way. We tend to be more in touch with our body. I mean, that's judgment. Whether we're more in touch with our bodies or not, we are more likely to speak up. And, you know, when you're a physician, unless you're a urologist that primarily sees men, most of your patients are women. That's just how it goes most of the time. I think that I, Fran, have a higher proportion of men for a female practitioner than a lot of women practitioners. And, you know, it has nothing to do with my, you know, presentation. I mean, it has to do with my presentation. What it is I'm pragmatic. That's what it is. I can, you know, when you talk to men, you're pragmatic. And the men listening to me are going, yep, she makes sense. So they come in because I make sense, not particularly because I'm cute or whatever. It's because whatevs. I have people who are listening to me on the radio, and they're probably listening to me, you know, they're doing carpentry or they're working in their cars. I mean, lots of people listen to me on the radio, male and female,
right.
But the men come in because for some reason I put them at ease and I'm able to talk to them in a brass tacks way, you know. And, you know, this is available to other women. If you want to get more men in your practice, you can do that. It's just a matter of, you know, letting them in and just talking, just down, being really down to earth about how you present stuff. Do you have an opinion, Ron, being a man, why it might be the case that I might have more men in my practice?
That's a really good question, because men generally do not tend to go to the doctor very
right
much.
Why do they come to me?
So why do they come to you?
Yeah,
because you're not the doctor, you're different.
Oh, because you used
I'm
to listen
really
to
sure.
me
you used... I listened to you for a number of years before I actually met you, because
yeah.
It was to me, okay, here it is. Natural medicine in my mind, in my men's mind, whatever it is, made sense. It was just more, it just made sense. And, you know, throwing pharmaceuticals at problems doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so I always was fascinated by it. Plus, I started doing things like, you know, for allergies, I was doing natural honey, and I was doing, you know, local honey. And I was, I had... Before I met you, I had a neti pot. I was definitely doing that. So, because I was after my allergy issues to try to see if I could do something about that.
Yeah.
And I had success with it. So, therefore, it was like, oh, this is interesting. I'll keep listening. Let's see what else we can find.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just, we don't like to go to the doctor.
Right.
And, but if we go to you, trying to figure this out. If we go to you, you tend to dig in a place that makes more sense. Therefore, we get better results without having to continually go to the doctor after, you know, time and time again, because we're not really fixed or cured.
Uh-huh.
Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, there are times when the doctor is extremely important.
Of course.
And you got to go.
Right.
But being someone who doesn't want to spend a very long period of time doing medical things, and of course recently I've done a lot of medical things.
Yeah.
It's just the alternative of going to you takes less of my time in the long run.
Yeah.
You're more time efficient. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, right. Because that's what I'm saying. I have a pragmatic approach. So anybody who has a pragmatic approach is going to work for a guy. And not that women don't have pragmatic approaches. It's just a matter of that's when you have that pragmatic approach, more men are going to come in regardless of your gender. I think that's what it is. So something like that. Anyway, and mind you, I see loads of women too, of course, because I still would say that my proportion of patients is going to be stacked towards women because that's who goes to the doctor. And the other thing to be clear about is when you're a naturopathic physician, you know what the most important thing is in naturopathic medicine?
No.
It's the same thing that's the most important thing in sales in New England.
People.
Yep, making relationships.
Relationships, yeah.
Yes, so you want to have a trusting relationship with the person. So you make connections. That's what you do. That is the most important thing. It is the number one thing. Doesn't matter. Magnesium doesn't matter. Anthocyanins don't matter, even though they matter. They don't matter. None of that matters if you can't connect with the person, and that is the most important thing. And you can sell them, you know, thousands of dollars worth of supplements. You can do the right hands-on treatment, you can give them the right piece of advice, but if you don't have the connection, it's not going to work. And right. I would rather, you know, not sell any supplements to a patient or give them the very basic magnesium and fish oil, which are two of my favorite things to offer people, and have that be all that they get and have a great connection with them. That's the most important thing. All right. So let's see what else Dr. Weiss had to say. Let's talk about postmenopause and low estrogen. So one of the deals is that, one of the things I've found in menopause is that is a mood thing. When you are in menopause, you have
no
issues.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your mood's a little more labile, and you can get moody. Mm. And so one of the things that's going on is estrogen supports serotonin function, and serotonin is an important neurotransmitter that makes you feel happy. And if you don't have enough good serotonin function, you're going to be depressed and you might be anxious as well. So one of the things that we'll see is that SSRIs, those are the drugs that increase serotonin in your body. They're serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And they tend to improve your estrogen function. That's one of the mechanisms by which you're cheerier when you take them, that they're increasing your estrogen function. And so I don't take SSRIs. I would prefer to eat foods with tryptophan in it. Maybe that's why I enjoy eating turkey so much, because it makes me happy. Also, what makes me happy is riding my bike. And that increases my serotonin function as well. Anyway, sertraline, which is an SSRI, has been shown to improve endothelial function for about 6 months. When you're in postmenopause, in women and who are postmenopausal, and by endothelial function, that means that the blood vessels are going to be more elastic, that they're going to have better turnover of fats, that you're going to be less likely to make those plaques, the atheromas and the arteriosclerotic plaques. So you're going to have less blockages. So it improves your endothelial function for about 6 months, then it stops working, because when you take SSRIs, ultimately your serotonin gets depleted. So because you're doing that reuptake, and then you just stop making enough serotonin anymore. So you want to try to improve your serotonin. Improving serotonin function in menopause is a good idea, but you may not want to rely on an SSRI. Now, if you're taking an SSRI and for any reason, because you're anxious, depressed, and it's working for you, and it's working for you ongoing, and every time you go off it, you feel worse, and you like your SSRI, I would say stay with the SSRI. SSRIs definitely have side effects, but they're not terrible. And you know that if there's a drug that I thought had terrible side effects, I tell you not to take it. Mm-hmm. I'd give you my opinion about it. But I don't feel that way about SSRIs. If you know, psychiatric drugs, if you need the psychiatric drug, take the psychiatric drug. I'm good with that. And the SSRIs, they definitely have side effects and you have to be careful with them. But if you need them to function and you're not particularly getting unwanted side effects, I'm all right with them. You know, my concern about them is that when you take them, they tend to blunt your response, that you just don't have the highs and lows. So you'll be the one that's in the movie theater, not laughing at the movie and also not crying at the sad parts. So you don't get to experience your emotions as much, but you won't be as labile in terms of your mood. And for a while you have better estrogen function. There are other ways to improve your estrogen function, but I'll talk about that later. But anyway, other ways to improve your serotonin function are, guess what? Exercise. So when you exercise, you increase your serotonin. That's one of the things that makes you cheerier. Getting enough rest, getting good sleep. If you're not sleeping well, then there's other ways to help you to sleep better. And the best way to help sleep is, guess what? Sleep hygiene. But getting good sleep will improve your serotonin function, so will exercise. Eating enough protein. If people go on diets where they're like, all right, I'm going to be a vegan. Now, nothing against being a vegan, but you just have to get enough protein. And if you're not getting the protein from animal sources, you have to find ways to get that tryptophan from, from plant sources and to get enough of it. And you can do that. And sometimes the way to do it is to take protein powders, but you have to be really creative about making sure you're getting tryptophan from plant sources. But if you're not a vegetarian, eating enough protein is a good idea. And, you know, turkey is known for having a lot of tryptophan in it. I don't know that it actually, it's thought to have a lot of tryptophan in it and therefore make you sleepy. I don't know that it has any more tryptophan in it than other sources of animal protein. So, you know, I would say if you're going to eat animal protein, eat clean protein and eat the one that works for you, that you like and works well with your body, and make sure it's from a clean source. And don't eat too much. Eat enough, the amount that works for you. Okay, so oxidized LDL, it's much more important to lower oxidized LDL than it is to lower regular LDL. So let me say that again. Ox LDL is more dangerous to the inside of your blood vessels than plain old LDL. LDL that is not oxidized. How does LDL?
So how does that happen?
Okay, right. So LDL gets oxidized because of life. Because, well, when you're running around, you're metabolizing.
Okay.
Yeah, you're running around and you're metabolizing stuff. And when you metabolize, you have oxidation. That's what happens when you burn fat and when you burn sugar. So you can use them to go run away from the bear or get on your bike or run up the stairs to come to WHUS. You're going to cause some oxidation. So just metabolizing causes oxidation. So if you have a lot of LDL around, it can oxidize. And then if you don't have good antioxidant function, your LDL is going to be more likely to get oxidized. You're going to do oxidation. You see my hands flapping, right? You can't see through.
Yeah, you have to pull yourself a little closer to the radio.
Right. Yeah. So when my hands are flapping, I'm oxidizing, you know, sugar and fats and stuff to make them flap like this. So anything I'm doing causes oxidation. So if I have good antioxidant function, that is, you know, I chomped on that great salad you gave me last night and it had all those greens and
that was good,
nuts
wasn't it?
And seeds and yeah, and tomatoes and carrots and purple produce and all those things I ate, that's going to give me better antioxidant function, so I'm less likely to make oxidized LDL. So if you have an LDL of 163, which is going to send your cardiologist, your standard cardiologist, your conventional cardiologist, you know, and screaming through the hills, right? You have an LDL of 163, and you have large buoyant LDL, and you have low oxidized LDL, you're at very low risk for cardiovascular disease. Mm. If you have an LDL of 98 and you have elevated oxidized LDL, and all of your low level of LDL is small and dense, you have a higher cardiovascular risk than that person who has the LDL of 163. The other thing to remember is, remember how we said that that statins are good for people who are between ages 40 and 75, that men 40 to 75 is the best target if they have cardiovascular risk. That means if you're 76, it's not so good for you anymore. Because you've made it to 76 and you haven't had a major cardiovascular event, you're probably not going to have one, regardless of what your cholesterol is. And we do see that. So what you do is you can get your oxidized LDL tested. You know, your doc can order oxidized LDL. I do it all the time. It used to be hard. It was only done by specialty labs and you had to send out special. Now your ordinary labs, they have agreements with the lab that does the oxLDL test, so you can get it ordered from just your regular doctor can order it and you can ask for it. And so your oxidized LDL can be lowered by hawthorn. Hawthorn is a lovely way to lower oxLDL, and you can get hawthorn solid extract, you can drink hawthorn tea, you can take hawthorn pills. full of anthocyanins. Guess what else lowers oxLDL? Purple produce. So what's the purple produce? Purple produce is going to be black and red grapes. And some of the purple produce isn't necessarily purple. It just has to have anthocyanins. So all your berries, your strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, you know how they say the darker the berry, the sweeter the juice? Well, that kind of holds here. So you're going to get more anthocyanins from blackberries than you are from raspberries, I believe. But definitely raspberries will help you. Blueberries, absolutely. Acai, you know, that sort of exotic, weird oily fruit from Brazil has a lot of proanthocyanins in them. Prunes, plums, raisins. Raisins are actually grapes. So black and red grapes, we said. Black beans. When you get your quinoa, get the red or the black. When you get your rice, get the red or the black. Kale, if you can get purple kale, get that. Purple cabbage, purple potatoes. So any produce that's expressing the color purple, which you can't walk by in nature without noticing. Thank you, Alice Walker. the color purple, and you know, now some people get tired of purple because, oh, it's so elevated. All those airy fairy people are so into the color purple. Well, guess what? They have a point, because purple in nature really is a high expression genetically of what the plant is going on. And it's so interesting that in the chakra system, purple is the color of the chakra. That's your interplanetary, interspiritual connection. So purple is a very important color. Whether you like it or not, it happens that it does really help your cardiovascular health. And if you want to get spiritual about that, purple heals your heart, you know? And when your heart, when your cardiovascular heart is functioning well, your spiritual heart functions well as well, too. Oh, boy. So there's the connection between the color purple and your cardiovascular health, and the fact that it's, you know, this sort of interplanetary, interpersonal, interspiritual color. And it also happens to be a great color to give you healthy gene expression. How cool is that? Is your mind exploding? I thought that was really fascinating. So anyway, the point is the color purple, if you eat it, lowers your oxidized LDL and can improve your cardiovascular health. So stuff that's purple. Oh, what did I say? Pomegranates and pomegranate juice. That's another one that has purple. I mean, I know they're not exactly purple, but they're ruby, but they have a lot of anthocyanins in them as well. People think beets also have anthocyanins. They actually don't. So I was telling people to eat purple produce, and they said, well, I hate beets. I'm like, I'm sorry you hate beets. Beets are really good for you, but they don't actually have anthocyanins. They have betalains. The pretty colors that are in beets are betalains. They're also really good for you, but they are not as much for gene expression as they are for nitric oxide production, and they're really good for you that way. And beets are really, like, if you want to have good endothelial function and have nice stretchy blood vessels and less atherosclerosis and lower blood pressure, beets are where to go. All these other, the anthocyanins help as well, but beets are a different thing because the way they work is by enhancing nitric oxide. Okay, here's another, here's some more cool stuff. So also norepinephrine increases, lowers oxidized LDL. So norepinephrine, if you have poor norepinephrine function because you're depressed, you're going to have worse cardiovascular health. So isn't that interesting? If you're depressed, you're going to have worse cardiovascular health. Your physical heart and your spiritual heart are going to be in worse shape if you're depressed. And there's a few mechanisms for that. One of them is the serotonin. One of them is the norepinephrine. So norepinephrine decreases oxidized LDL. Super interesting. Okay, so norepinephrine, how do you increase norepinephrine? By just doing stuff to make you happy. Whatever that is. So happiness makes norepinephrine. Coffee makes norepinephrine. So when you consume, I'm looking at Ron getting excited about caffeine over here.
Mm-hmm.
So caffeine in general, one of the ways that caffeine works is it increases epinephrine and norepinephrine. So caffeine in general is thought of as being a good thing for cardiovascular health until it gives you arrhythmias. Then it's not so good. If you're a person who gets arrhythmias from too much caffeine and you know, you're a slow metabolizer of caffeine, so you tend to get palpitations and heart rhythm issues like me, I really have to ration my caffeine. But if that's not you and you metabolize caffeine quickly, you're kind of lucky because the caffeinated beverages have a lot of antioxidants in them. So organic coffee is really good for your cardiovascular health.
I'm pounding my fist into the air.
Yay. And it's also, it has a lot of flavonoids in it, which are great antioxidants. And it's really good for your liver and it causes more detoxification. All right. So here's another scary thing. Except for the blockage of the left main, so you have a bunch of coronary arteries. The coronary arteries attach to your heart, and they are the ones that feed the heart muscle wall. So except for the left main coronary artery, getting a bypass doesn't reduce the risk of heart attack. What the reason you get bypasses is because they improve chest pain. Yes, because when you have blocked coronary arteries, you're not getting as much circulation to the heart muscle. And when you get decreased circulation to the heart muscle, the heart doesn't like that. So it's going to let you know that that's happening and it's going to cause pains. It's going to signal you to do something about it. But except for the left main is a big feeder of the heart muscle wall. That's if you bypass that so you can get other arteries hooked in to feed the heart muscle wall, that does reduce your risk of a heart attack. But the other ones, bypassing the other arteries, the left anterior descending or any of the others, doesn't reduce the risk of another MI. All they do is stop chest pain. Putting stents in as well stops chest pain. It doesn't stop the risk of heart attack. So you have to do all the other stuff. You have to do cardiac rehab. Cardiac rehab works. Eating better, reducing your oxidation, eating your purple produce, taking your antioxidants, getting exercise, making your life happier, reducing stress. That's what really helps your cardiovascular health. Surprise, surprise.
This isn't new news.
So this nugget was a mind blower for me. This was like, if I forget everything else from the conference, this was really great. Constipation can give you heart attacks.
What?
All right. Listen.
Really?
So let's take you from point A to point B.
I'm dying to hear this one.
Okay. So guess what? So how do you get from point A to point B? This is like when I was in high school and I had to do the proofs in geometry. Prove that, side angle side equals, I don't even remember. But anyway, this is how do you get from point A to point B? How is it? Okay, we know that A equals B, but how is it even possible? So I just made an assertion that oxLDL increases your risk of heart attacks. We know that oxLDL increases your risk of heart attacks. But constipation increases your risk of heart attacks. How can that be? One is your intestines and one is your heart. How can that be? When you hear, you'll be like, you're going to go like, oh, all right. So when you are constipated, it increases your oxLDL. But it's my colon and my heart. How can that be? Here's why. One of the ways that you manage your cholesterol is you excrete it because cholesterol is processed in the liver. You have bile. Any of the toxins and extra stuff that your liver decides you don't need anymore gets put into the bile ducts, and the bile ducts eventually dump into your digestive system, and you eventually poop out stuff that you don't need, right? So one of those things is cholesterol. If you are constipated, anything that's targeted for release, you know, fiber and organic matter and food that you didn't digest and, all the microbiota that are going to come out. Anything that's targeted for detox, you know, and your bile contains a lot of detox products from inside the liver that your liver's detoxified, and that's going to wind up coming out in your stool. And some of those things are oxidized, and also fermentation goes on in your colon. So one of the things that your liver sends out is cholesterol. So you have cholesterol sitting in your colon that's earmarked for excretion. In fact, the drug it's a drug that causes the mechanism by which it lowers cholesterol is to cause more cholesterol excretion. So if you take that drug and you are constipated, you probably increased your risk of a heart attack because it's increasing excretion of cholesterol through your stool. Probably increase, and you're constipated. You're increasing your risk of a heart attack.
Hence the disclaimer on the commercial, probably.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's obviously there's side effects.
Yeah.
But that's probably. But how is that happening? It's very simple. The cholesterol sitting in your colon waiting to be excreted. And while it's sitting there, you've got bacterial fermentation going on. You've got compounds that are earmarked for excretion. They're just sitting there. They're waiting. Some of them are oxidized compounds. There's free radicals in there that are waiting to come out. The cholesterol's sitting there. It's getting oxidized by the fermentation and all the things that are going on. You have more and if it's still not coming out, one of the things about constipation is you can reabsorb toxins that were targeted for release.
I was wondering about that, if that
yes.
would get reabsorbed into your system.
That's
so
it.
That's not good, because that's supposed to be moving on out.
That's right.
So again, you know, you gotta move.
Yeah.
To move, you have to move. And you also have to drink a fair amount of liquid in order to do that,
yes,
too. Water helps a lot.
And eat fiber. So
right.
So that's the issue, that if you're not regular, cholesterol is going to sit in your colon, become oxidized, get reabsorbed, and now you've just increased your oxidized LDL.
Wow.
So high fiber decreases oxLDL. A high fiber diet will decrease your oxLDL only because you're having more regular bowel movements. And if the more things move through, the more likely you are to get rid of that cholesterol. And if any of it's oxidized, it's going to come out. And if it doesn't stick around long enough to get oxidized, then you have less oxLDL. So high fiber, you got a couple things going on. High fiber just means you're going to be more regular. You're going to have one or more bowel movements a day, which is ideal. And the other thing is that if you're eating a high fiber diet, generally high fiber things have a lot of antioxidants in it. So you're going to cause antioxidation of that LDL.
Right. So I think you just answered my next question, which was, hey, doc, how many times should I go a day?
At least one. More is better, but at least once.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
we consider
1 to 2 is good.
Yes. We consider that. And there are people who they go every time they eat, and that's fine, as long as you're having healthy bowel movements and there's no, you know, you don't have an excessive gas, bloating, constipation, but you
right.
find that every time you eat a meal, you go, that's fine. That's normal. That's actually normal, because
right.
you're when you eat, you're setting up the gastrocolic reflex. Because Charlie yells down to your colon.
There's Charlie again.
Yeah, yells down to your colon and says, all right, guys, make some room. Stuff's got to come out.
Right.
Stuff coming in up here. We got to make room. So that's normal. That's a nerve signal that goes from your stomach to your colon through your whole digestive system.
And as I learned in the hospital, when I was in the hospital and needed to make that happen to be able to get out of the hospital, gravity and movement, like just the idea of walking and having that constant pounding to the surface,
yes,
helps that all happen.
Right. So exercise, if you're constipated, one of the ways to help constipation is exercise. Yeah, and it could just be a walk. Absolutely.
Just go for a walk.
Yeah.
You know, go for a long walk. Spend an hour. Go for
yeah.
a walk.
Or, well, as much as a person can do.
As much as you can do. But it
yeah.
really makes a big difference, because everything just starts churning and burning and getting ready to move out.
Right.
So.
Well, you have both gravity and circulation happening
right.
when you do that. Absolutely.
It's great.
So, yeah. So that was a lot of nuggets, and we're almost done. It's very interesting. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we should just wrap up with this is a cardiovascular health kind of day. I think we should just stick with that here. So the idea is that, so if you're interested in getting your doc to do some testing for you to see where you're at in terms of your cardiovascular health, it would be a good idea to ask for that oxidized LDL test. It's, you know, your regular labs can order it. You can ask for, you certainly want to know about your triglycerides as well. And your doc is going to talk to you about your triglycerides. If you have elevated triglycerides, you lower triglycerides. Your doctor might give you a drug called fenofibrate, which has side effects and people don't feel well on it frequently. But you can lower triglycerides by exercising fasted. So if your triglycerides are high, high triglycerides are a problem. So where I said that LDL, high LDL isn't necessarily a problem, especially if it's large and buoyant and it's not oxidized. High triglycerides are a problem, and that's simply the form that fat takes when it first enters your bloodstream. The problem with triglycerides is they are easily oxidized, and once again, they can cause damage to the inside of your arteries. So triglycerides will raise if you eat too much starch and sugar and you don't get enough exercise. And people think that eating too much fat, like eating too much pizza or eating too much dairy products, is going to give them high triglycerides. What gives you the highest triglycerides is too much starch and sugar. So if you drop your starch and sugar, but you don't particularly drop your protein or your saturated fat, your triglycerides will come down. The other thing that chews up triglycerides is cardio exercise. Not so much weight training, but if you did weight training at a cardio pace, it would work. But cardio exercise for sure. And so one of the best ways to get those triglycerides down is to do cardio exercise fasted. And by fasted, that doesn't mean no water and it doesn't mean no liquid. If you want to have some coffee, it just can't have any calories and it can't have any sugar or fat in it. So it has to be you can have anything non-caloric. So you could have water, you could have coffee, you could have tea, things that have no calories in them, and then go out for your exercise. A great way to do that is first thing in the morning, fasted in the cold. And that actually helps you burn more fat and lose weight. So you get out for a walk first thing in the morning before your breakfast. And if you are a person who you are hypoglycemic and you can't possibly get any exercise fasted, then don't do it. But, eat as little as possible. But if you can do it, if you find that, and I don't recommend exercising dehydrated ever. So definitely drink water and even carry water with you if you want to. But exercising first thing in the morning, fasted, or exercising fasted burns triglycerides. Cardio exercise in general burns triglycerides too. So if you can't make it out first thing in the morning, you do it another day, it will still help. But it will help more if you do it in a fasted state. So that was great. So big shout out to Decker Weiss for teaching us so much stuff and for allowing me to give a good good summary of what's going on and the ideas of cardiovascular health. We have so much more to get to. So next week we're going to start out with Dr. Wilson and Hashimoto's disease, and we'll see if we can get through more of the topics. But that I did get really great information. All right, so I'm gonna wrap up for now for this week. And you have been listening to Radio Naturopath. It is the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs.